supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. I often say the hunger to be known exceeds the hunger to be loved. I think it's a human calling to be known for who we are. After all, that's why we tell the stories of our lives, so that we can be known to other. But how do we get known? We need someone to listen, and not just nod, but to truly hear our stories. It helps us integrate into our species, our support system, our network, helps us become who we are. But what about the listener? What happens to the listener? Hearing stories changes our lives. If that wasn't true, I might not be here today. I tell the story about how right after my accident, I was suicidal and all I wanted to do was die. I felt I was worthless and hopeless and helpless. One day, I was in intensive care and a nurse came up to me and said, "You're a psychologist." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "I'd really like to talk to you about something." Well, it turned out she had a terrible loss in her life, and she was feeling despair also. She didn't know if she could carry the burden. For the first time, someone was talking to me and didn't care about catheters and IVs and my paralysis. She just cared about what was happening with her, and for the first time, that's all I cared about. Her story changed me, because I felt so connected with this woman, and I felt I could survive as a quadriplegic. I feel so connected with her 34 years later. Listening helps us develop a close contact with others and with our own lives. Today, we'll be talking with three therapists about how they were transformed by witnessing the stories of Holocaust survivors and their families. Our guests are Drs. B. Hollander, Goldfein, Ruthie Kaiser, and Killian Fritsch. B. Hollander Goldfein is director of the AAMFT Accredited Postgraduate Certification Program in Marriage and Family Therapy at the Council for Relationship. She's also director of the research project Transforming Trauma, and we're going to talk much more about that on the show. Ruthie Kaiser is a senior therapist at the Council for Relationship. She's worked as a nurse with cancer patients. She's been a practitioner of yoga and meditation for 20 years and uses this in her work. Dr. Killian Fritsch is a psychotherapist with over 30 years' practice here in Philadelphia. B, let's start with you. Your book begins with your Transcending Trauma project. It started 20 years ago, yes? Right. So tell us what that project was about.
The project was focused on coping and adaptation after extreme trauma. And a group of us were studying the trauma literature, and the focus at that time was almost exclusively on the negative sequelae of trauma. And that did not make sense to us, because all of us knew someone who had been through something horrific. Many of us knew Holocaust survivors, and other people had gone through horrific things. And we knew that most of these people were coping and adapting and surviving well, and growing their families, launching their children. And so we dedicated ourselves to understanding from the survivor's viewpoint what it meant to rebuild after the trauma. And in order to do that, we committed ourselves to doing in-depth life histories with survivors, children, and their grandchildren. 300 with 300 interviews of survivors and their family members.
I want to ask you to generalize, and I know that's very unfair with this population, But I would hope the effects of trauma, of course it gets transmitted in one way, shape, or form, but I would hope kind of naturally that the effects of trauma would diminish in each subsequent generation. You studied three generations.
I would say that that's probably true if you're talking about the trauma. The issue, though, is how the trauma impacts the survivor. So we have found that there is a continuum of response to the trauma from healthy and productive and happy to those survivors and survivor families that are more troubled.
Yeah, to use your words, those that leave a legacy of pain.
Right. So, and within that continuum, there's always the Holocaust as the backdrop for the survivor, but then there's the family relationships, the relationships within the marriage, and then the parenting of the second generation. And if the survivors, because of their own life experience and their own strengths, can parent well and raise their children in a healthy fashion, and then the children go on to live healthy and happy and productive lives, you don't see the intergenerational transmission in the same way. But for survivor families that were somehow left impaired or because of their limited backgrounds could not rebuild healthy families, and in their nuclear families parented with conflict, without positive attachment, without focus on the children, in ways that were troubling to the children, that second generation as adults do experience problems. It becomes easy to attribute all of that to Holocaust legacy and transmission.
Right.
But it's really the impact on the survivor and how that survivor was able to rebuild. And if they could not rebuild well, then you see the cost of that in the second generation.
So it, even with the Holocaust survivors, it's like I say to my patients, it's never about the thing. It's about what the thing means to you.
What it means to you, how it impacts you, and how you translate that into life, yes.
Even though two different people can experience the same thing. Let's jump ahead to this project, the Narrative Reflections Project. So you started reviewing in-depth interviews of two members of one family, correct? And why did you do this? And you did it with six therapists.
Right.
Five others.
Why did we do this? I would say this was really the brainchild of Lucy Raisman. And she was studying narrative therapy at the time and was reading a newsletter put out by the Dulwich Center, where therapists from around the world were reflecting upon the immigration experience. And she brought this back to the project. She was a member of the Transcending Trauma Project team, and she said, we could do this. We could really ask outside readers to reflect upon the experience of the survivors and their children. And so we decided that that would be a great project because there's enormous impact.
Well, you know, you were talking, you co-edited this book, Narrative Reflections, with Lucy Raisman. Our producer, Gita Simons, had an opportunity to talk with her very recently about her experience here and what she was looking to accomplish. Let's listen.
It was an opportunity to learn about ourself and discover self, to feel known and heard and understood. It was such a connection.
That was the co-editor, Lucy Raisman, talking about her experience. Killian, I want to turn to you. You said in your chapter that listening to the details of these interviews created a safe place to describe how your world was changed by being allowed into theirs.
Right.
So that asks for an explanation.
Well, I had never come upon the stories of other people that resonated so deeply with my own experience. In other words, for all of the professional experiences I had had in my life, I really never felt that it was possible for someone else to get who I was in my fullness. And reading the stories, or reading the transcripts of Saba and Braca, I felt, in a sense, as if I had come home, and that I could come into myself more fully as a result of having been taken into their lives in the detail that came through in the interviews.
You, as I listen, you can see my furrowed brow.
Right.
So I owe you an explanation for my furrowed brow. You've been a therapist for 30 years.
Right.
I mean, you've heard stories of anguish and horrific childhoods. What's different about that? And these weren't even sitting with you.
Right.
They were. What's that? What happened? What's different about this?
Well, I think there's two things. The first is that in this project, I did not have to function as a therapist. And the second thing is that there were stories in my life that really, in many ways, made me who I am, that had remained unspoken for a number of different reasons, partly because of the horrors that were contained in the stories, and also the complexity of these stories and my worry, my anxiety, that it was just too much to say in a short period of time that anybody could grasp. But the complexity of the stories of Saba and Braca gave me the permission to do that for myself.
So we know that Saba was a mother in the Holocaust, and we're going to hear a bit more about her. We know that Braca was her daughter, and we're going to hear more about her, who's sitting here in the studio with me. That's B is the Braca.
Braca is my Hebrew name.
So I want to turn to you, Ruthie, because you've got your own story here, because, you know, you come to the story in the same way. Your mother was a Holocaust survivor. This had to be you and I were close friends back in the beginning, and I know it was very difficult for you in the beginning. How so?
Well, I think to start, Dan, I could probably say I didn't know that my mother was a Holocaust survivor. And I was just speaking. My mom passed away some years ago, but her brother is still alive, my uncle, and I was speaking with him last night. And I didn't know, because my mother was not in a concentration camp. Her sisters were taken from the orphanage in which the three of them were together.
And
her
mother
sisters
was
were
not,
taken, and my mother was not. So I didn't know that she was a Holocaust survivor. And so I didn't know that I could call myself a child of. It's almost like it didn't count. So for me, some of what you've all said today, I feel like I was so much further behind. I didn't even know that I was avoiding pain. I didn't even know that I had a story. Killian, you said something that now I can't recall, and I thought, I didn't even know that I didn't know myself. There was so much inside, and I didn't know it. Because her message so powerfully had been, don't look.
When this started, when this project started, when you were first invited into this project, you began to know that you were suffering. So what were you afraid of?
I think, Dan, it was beneath consciousness. I agreed to be part of the group. I sought out the invitation. I agreed to show up for a meeting. I agreed that I would do my homework and write something, and then I would show up at the meetings and have written nothing. And my contribution was to discuss why, once again, have I not been able to do what I was told or what I had agreed to do. I didn't even know how to approach the question, what was I afraid of, let alone the answer.
It speaks to how frightened you were of you or something inside of your mother or both. It sounded like you were terribly frightened.
My understanding of it today is that I was afraid of pain.
Yeah, yeah.
And not as, it wasn't even as conscious, again, as B says about not wanting to cause it or something. I was just terrified of the whole subject.
Tell us the story of what got you to this project.
So my older son, when he was in eighth grade, the school was taking a trip to the Holocaust Museum in D.C. He was going, and I thought, well, I can't let him go by himself because he will see things and he will have no language for them, and I have no language for them, so I should at least go and be with him so the two of us can have no language together. So I went and was so profoundly unsettled. I started to drown. I started to literally, I remember thinking, I'm just going to drown walking around. And then I found him and took his hand and remembered that I had to be there for him. And so that pulled me back into the planet. Mm-hmm. And then I came home and began asking, who could I speak to about the Holocaust and survivors and trying to deal with it? And I didn't know. I said to a friend, do you know that there's a section of books on the Holocaust at Borders? I was shocked. She said, do you know there's a Department of Holocaust Studies at Penn? I had no idea. Huh. So that was the beginning.
I want to observe something that I have a feeling you experienced, and I'll turn to you, Killian. You said that you had the overwhelming feeling of inadequacy,
right?
As you read this, and many others in the book said they had the same feelings. Did you have that feeling growing up, inadequate?
No, but there were. I would say, well, that's not entirely true. My father. I had a feeling of difference.
Tell us, just give us briefly what was going on with your father and your mother.
Well, they both spent significant periods of their childhood in the hospital, in a day when visitors weren't allowed, and they had to spend, I mean, like, we're talking years now.
Right. Your father had polio.
Well, my father had polio and my mother had rheumatic fever. And there was a sort of an ethic of not speaking about pain.
Right.
Of
did you know they were in pain?
Sure.
Growing up.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But they didn't talk about it.
No. I mean, as I say, one was just supposed to bear it. One was just supposed to just tolerate the inevitable presence of pain in one's life.
I want to, we've got to take a short break. When we come back, I want to hear much more about, we need to hear more about Saba and Bracha and what happened, how that transformed the two of you, if not the three of you. We're talking about bearing witness, how it transforms us. We're talking with B. Hollander Goldfein. She is probably one of the prime movers of this very important project. Ruthie Kaiser is a senior therapist at the Council for Relationships, and she's one of the six therapists that were involved and has her own history of second-generation Holocaust survivor. Killian Fritsch is a psychotherapist who was also one of the therapists in the project, who was profoundly moved by what happened here and how it changed his life. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM. We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with three therapists, Bea Hollander-Goldfein, Ruthie Kaiser, and Killian Fritsch, about bearing witness, about how bearing witness can really transform our lives. Bea, before we get too far here, the first interviews were really about you and your family, your bracha. Tell us about your mother, who was a Holocaust survivor. What kind of person was she, and how did the experience affect you and the rest of the family?
Well, I credit my mother with being a survivor who could really hold on to life. And whatever she continued to suffer in terms of her own sadness and loss, her perspective about me was that I should live as normal a life as is possible. And she enabled me to do that with a clear message that I should and I could. The other great, I think, blessing with my mother is that she communicated about her experiences in the war, about her family. It was never closed to me. So I always knew what they were. And I knew not just the story, but I also knew her feelings. Now, granted, if I started to cry, she would stop telling me. So I learned not to cry. But knowing what happened to her fully was very important for me.
How old were you?
I would say that I don't have a time that I look back and say I didn't know. So I can't put an age on that, except that I know it was always part of my life. It was never obsessive. She didn't force it on me. She responded to my questions. She realized I needed to know, and probably she needed to be known. That there were very important things she told me within her stories. So the fact that it was open was very important for me. And I think that also gave me a measure of health and sort of emotional stamina to deal with it. And that it's not just the horror of the stories, it's who my mother was in the stories that also helped me a great deal. I learned about her, and I could then emulate aspects of her that moved me and meant a lot to me in terms of her before the war, during, and after. So I see her as a woman of great strength, although many people met her would not necessarily call her strong, but I know that her strength was inside. She was open to her sadness and pain, but wanted normalcy for me, and allowed that, where some survivors, in their interaction with their children actually feel guilty for moving out and in the world. I had the space with her to do that and be that. So I credit her with giving me, teaching me how to be a survivor.
Did she suffer?
Did my mother suffer?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, a great deal. She was in the camps.
No.
What do you mean?
When she was raising you, was she a woman who suffered? With her history.
Yes, I would say that it was there for her. My father suffered from depression and anxiety.
Yeah.
She dealt with that all the time. She was shot at the end of the war and suffered the injuries of that throughout her life. And
physical and emotional.
Physical and emotional. And again, she would speak of it when it was relevant. When 9/11 happened, she responded with great upset. You know, she said, "Our families also don't have graves.
I wonder, speaking of 9/11, I wonder how you and you, Ruthie, reacted when you heard a report recently about what was happening in North Korea, comparing it to a Holocaust or Holocausts we've been bearing witness to all over the world, many, many in our lifetimes. I just wonder if either of you had a personal reaction to that. Ruthie?
I have such strong reactions whenever I hear the word. When I hear the word, it's hard for me to process my thoughts. It's such an unfathomable. Whenever I hear the word Holocaust, what I do today that's different, one of the ways that I've been transformed by this project, is that the word would terrify me and shut me down. And I've now learned that I would turn away from pain. And now I can say turn toward the awfulness that's happening when they showed the photos of what's happening in the Syrian refugee camp. And I thought, turn toward that pain.
What happens to you when you turn towards it? What does that mean? It sounds like therapist talking.
No, it's very real.
Yeah, so
it's
tell
my
me.
Real self. Where I am in the process.
No,
which is,
no. What does it mean to turn towards the pain? What are the emotions, the thoughts?
So I have to answer the only way I know how. The first thing I become aware of is the habit that wants to turn away.
Okay.
So maybe I become aware that my chest gets tight or my throat gets tight or I feel myself begin to shut down. And over some years of exploring this, I've come to know what the signals are, and it's some kind of physical in my body tightness. And so that's the first thing I am aware of is that I want to turn away. I want to say, don't listen to that story. Yeah. And then I can sit still and take a deep breath or put my hand on my heart and say, no, you've grown through this. You can turn toward it now.
This is a very human story because I think most people do turn away and aren't even aware, you know, or they say, oh, that's too bad. I want to turn to you, Killian, and because I was thinking of you when Bea was talking about a relationship with her mother and had this open relationship where Mom talked about everything, including her pain, and your family was the opposite.
Well, not really. I mean, it was and it wasn't. I mean, I spent many hours with my father in the car. And he told me many stories of his own childhood, but I spent a lot of time with my extended family in the same way. But there was one story that was not told, and that was the story of my father's father.
Oh, I want to hear that. That's quite
a
story.
In 1917, was a baker in East St. Louis, Illinois, and there was a race riot. And he rescued. He went out in his bakery wagon, and he rescued some young African-American men from the mob that was attacking them, and even was shot at and close enough that he heard the bullet go by his ear. And he took some of these kids back to his bakery, and he hid them in the loft. That became known to members of the community, and there was a young African-American man that was lynched in front of his bakery, and the bakery was later firebombed. And then my grandfather got sick with encephalitis, and my father contracted polio. So all of those things happened at the same time.
So now you're reading about Saba.
Right, exactly.
And what's happening to you while you're reading about this openness? Ruthie kind of addressed it, but what's happening to you now?
Well, I felt like Saba and her story was a place where my story could fit, could belong. I could belong in the story of Saba because that my story wasn't too much. And there was a way that the story of my grandfather's failure in some ways became unspoken in my own family. And this allowed me to speak that story in a way that was very freeing and also honoring of him.
He was considered a failure.
He was. He was considered an abject failure, unfortunately, by my grandmother. And an awful lot of pressure then got put on my father to redeem the honor of the family, which is sort of the creation of this method of just going and carrying through. And, you know, I was told a lot of stories, but the one, you know, one thing one couldn't do is sort of like give in or like let down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds like a therapist in training if I ever had heard one. We're talking today about bearing witness and what it does to us as therapists and what it does to anybody who listens deeply to the story of someone else's suffering. And as we heard from Killian earlier, what happens when we listen deeply without an agenda, without trying to fix anything or help anybody? Just listen deeply and try to be part of this story. It changes us. And when we come back from a 60-second break, I want to talk more about what this project did for all three of you. My guests are therapists, B. Hollander Goldfein, and she's with the Marriage Council, and she started the project along with Lucy Raisman. Ruthie Kaiser is also a senior therapist at the Council for Relationship. Killian Fritch is not with the Council for Relationships, but he's a good guy anyway, and he's been practicing here in the Philadelphia area for over 30 years. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM. We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about bearing witness and how that changes us. We're with B. Hollander Goldfein, Ruthie Kaiser, and Killian Fritch, therapists all. I've got a question. I don't want to romanticize 100% this business of bearing witness. There are many people we all know, and I'll turn to you, B, we all know who listen to stories of trauma and burn out, quit, run away. It's called compassion fatigue. Mm. So what's the difference between your experience and those who have compassion fatigue?
Well, I would say that in the experience of bearing witness to the survivor testimonies, and doing it as a group, if I could contrast that to just being a therapist and hearing the endless stories of pain, as a group, we sort of worked together around our stories. We would ask each other questions. We would help each other probe past where we felt like stopping. We had traveled the journey, but not quite. And so we always had friends, somebody sort of with us in the journey. And because we pushed at each other, at least I gave myself permission as being part of the group and an editor for all the reflections, I gave myself permission to ask whatever I felt like asking, whatever came to mind, and wherever my heart went. Mm. And in the pushing, whatever came up in the group conversation, it always led to something else, some insight, some growth, some deeper understanding, some deep bond within the group. And so we grew with this process.
So amazing things happen when you release your grasp on trying to manage everything moment by moment.
Yes.
And you're just honest with your with yourself, and you open up. I want to quote
something about this?
Sure, sure, Killian.
The notion of witnessing comes out, I mean, a fella that I had a great deal of affection for, Michael White, he said that witnessing should answer the question, how are you different now than you were before? What has this witnessing done for you whereby you're actually coming out of this process being reminded of something different or actually transformed into something different? And I think that doing it in a group format like that facilitated that kind of movement instead of the sort of the grinding down into the compassion fatigue that you mentioned. And it does require a kind of exploratory impetus as opposed to, again, as you say, managing the process or managing the phenomenon. Mm. So,
Killian, I want to follow up with you on another issue. You commented about something Bea said. She said there's a place where the pain is too great to bear. The pain makes you question the value of living.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask you, Bea already said it, I want to ask you, Killian, and you, Ruthie, have you experienced that kind of pain where it's so great you question the value of living?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And on more than one occasion. One of our daughters contracted meningitis when she was 15 months old. Another time, my wife was involved in a horrific car accident. And more recently, she essentially has been sort of part of her has been lost to the ravages of Parkinson's disease. So the way that I've made meaning of my life has had to undergo that kind of a transformation, or else the meaning itself could be
right.
Not there.
Right.
Yeah.
Ruthie, what about you?
That's a tough question. I'm just thinking about it and thinking, I believe my experience continued for many years to be, I don't know how to be with the pain. So I would run away from it.
Yeah.
I would numb myself out by being too busy or running here or running there.
That's how you reacted to the pain that's too great to bear.
Right. Right. And just now I did have an interesting thought that I don't know if it's true. It's just a thought. As though my mom just showed up here, and I have often likened my mother to the scene in Gone with the Wind when Scarlett O'Hara is standing there. She's just gone back to Tara. She's dug up the carrots. She eats them, and then she vomits, and she says, as God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again, and she clenches her fist. I often think of my mom that way, and I think, no, I would never do that. I would never take my life. I'm too strong.
Hmm.
And I don't know if that's resilience or was her brittleness. And perhaps it used to be true for me that it was brittle. And today it's the ground I stand on that now I know how to be with it.
Sure. You know, people accuse me of being strong and because of all the adversity I've lived with. And I think it's the opposite. I think real strength is being comfortable with your weakness. Mm. But, you know, it's just looked at as being strong. I want to share something with you. I had an adventure, and I wrote a poem. I've written two poems in the last 6 weeks. And I don't even know if this qualifies as a poem, but I do want to share it with you because it there's a piece of me throughout this poem, and there's a piece of everyone who suffers. It's called Broken Lives and Open Hearts. When life comes at you, bare-knuckled and bloodthirsty, and you find yourself lying naked and beaten in an unfamiliar land, and you feel the world is watching you, vulnerable. So you hide your anguish, too scared to cry, because if you do, you might never stop. And everything you thought was true is now gone. So without a roadmap, you get up, frightened and fragile, and you take your first tentative step into the unknown. You go to doctors to heal your body, but the scars are permanent. And you see other doctors to heal your broken heart. Those scars are permanent, too. And after the shock and the anger and the self-pity and the resentment, when you're too exhausted to fight against the truth of your life, you wake up, perhaps for the first time. And finally, you cry oceans of tears. You cry for all you've lost. You cry for this good person who suffers, and you cry for all who suffers. And so it begins. It's different from before. You find yourself not as strong physically, not even strong enough to hide your own vulnerability. And then you notice the air itself smells sweeter, and the sun is brighter. Your love is less tentative and more generous. And you begin loving more people and then all living things. And loving seems easier and more abundant than ever before. And you close your eyes and you hold your life and you realize that all of this love comes through the scar tissue in your broken heart. And
amen.
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 Amen. And I was watching your faces, and all three of you were right there with me. Ruthie, I cut you.
What I wanted to say, it's a beautiful, beautiful, heartfelt, thoughtfully, exquisitely written. And what I wanted to say is, I think in my inarticulate way, that's what this book has been through, has meant to me. That's the transformation. I used to be afraid. I used to have to hide. I used to have to deprive myself of all sorts of things in order to not feel. I've come to be able to feel. And whereas I was angry, I don't know if I was angry with my mother or what I had suffered as a result of her inability to speak, I have so much compassion for her now. And for myself, perhaps the young woman, the young child who suffered, and for her and my brother and sister, and as you say, and all living beings. And my heart has opened, and it was through this group and with tremendous thanks to Bea and Killian that we all did this together.
Bea, tell us what happened to you. I mean, this was your life here. The deepest emotions of those you and your mother experienced were open up for six people to bear witness.
So let me start by saying that in response to your poem, that as a child, I described the positive relationship with my mother and the freedom to sort of be a kid and be normal. On the other side, I knew Holocaust stories. I read the books. I would watch the film sometimes over and over again. So I would have some very dark times as a child, and I would be in the darkness, and I would scream at God. I would question God. What is this? What is this life? How could this be that there could be so much suffering at the hands of other human beings? And I would ask the question that you mentioned before, why live? That's not the wish to die per se, but it is the question of how do you live day by day? And I would ask myself that question really through the night with hours of crying, as your poem mentions. And I would come out of that with the sense that the only important thing in life are people. And that oriented me, and that gave me a meaning in life. So people were the only thing important. Yes, you do all the other materialistic things, but it was always about people. And so, yes, I was born to be a therapist. And so I am a therapist, and I am a mother, and I am a grandmother. And I do those things, you know, full tilt. But there was another thing that I not really discovered, but knew that this project, this book, took me to another level, and that is, it was always what I could do for people. Can I be a good mother in the sense of what can I do for my children? What can I do for my grandchildren? What, how can I help my clients? How can I be better? How can I be trained? As a teacher, it's how do I master the material? And the class was good because I mastered the material. It was so never about me.
What shifted?
And how it was never did it about shift? Me. Okay, so what shifted was in this experience with the eight of us, sitting and exploring our lives to its deepest place and allowing myself to be who I naturally was, not what I learned, not what I studied, not the cookies I served, but where did I want to question my friends, my colleagues, and giving myself permission to do it, and then realizing that I connected with them, that there was an overlapping humanity, but to say it more directly, that they said to me, I have grown through you. I've grown because the questions you asked. It finally hit me on a deeper level that what I bring to life is not just everything I master and learn and give, but I can also say to myself that it's because of who I am.
Who you are.
Now that was transformative.
Yeah, you're not kidding. Killian, tell us, what transformed? How are you different, if you are?
Well, I am. Over 5 years ago, when you were on, when you had B. Hollander Goldfein and Henry Perrins on this show, I tuned in to listen to B, and I ended up getting in therapy with Henry. Because I knew there were things I needed to explore in a different modality than what I had already done. And that exploration has allowed me to really sort of sit with myself very differently in a way that I had not known before. And it's, you know, the journey continues. But the turbulence and the worry that I carried with me is greatly reduced. And I think I'm a better therapist as a result.
So. Sure. Sure you are. You know, bearing witness does open us up. And what we're learning is, you know, the more we can stay open, the more we can hold each other's lives. You know, I talk often about the work of Kristen Neff, who, you know, talks about self-compassion. She's really on the forefront with this work. And, you know, without self-compassion, nothing happens. Mm. Self-compassion even correlates very highly with weight loss, you know, or, you know, it's compassion for the body, not unlike what you know, Ruthie said about feeling the body and taking ownership. So that's one of the things that happened. You know, I said the hunger to be known. So, you know, what touches me about this group and is really moving is that everyone in there had a safe place. You connected by dint of your all of your vulnerability. And that's how we change. That's what intimacy is all about. I regret to tell you that we're out of time. So I want to thank all three of you so much for coming out, for doing this project, and for sharing your lives with us. It's just great work.
It's been wonderful to be part of all of it.
The title of the book?
Title of the book. Go.
It's called Narrative Reflections, How Witnessing Their Stories Changes Our Lives, edited by Lucy Raisman and B. Hollander Goldfein.
It's a wonderful book, and I highly, highly recommend it.
And there's no show long enough to get into what this means to all of us.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Thank you. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
To Download our podcast. Go to whyy.org/voices. You can reach us. We're at Twitter at Voices in the Fam. I'm at drdangottlieb.com. And hey, my new book is being released today. So rush out to the bookstores and send me an email about what you think about it. It's called The Wisdom We're Born With, Reawakening Faith in Ourselves. The engineer for today's show has been Mr. Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Gita Simons is our producer. Oh yeah, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.